This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. Bill Russell and I are with Simon Singh. You talked about these three guys at Stanford and these three guys at MIT. Well, there are two interesting twists to this, and I think it goes back to how complex the rest of the world is in addition to math. A, these six guys together, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of brain power to solve tough problems. Much of this stuff, with big exceptions, much of this stuff seems too big for one human mind to wrap itself around. The other part that I found so fascinating is that unbeknownst to the world, this work had already been done, but everybody was sworn to secrecy.
Yes, I mean, in 1997, it emerged that British cryptographers in the very early 70s had been working on this. You have the NSA in America, the National Security Agency. We have GCHQ, the Government Communications Headquarters. Same role, making codes and breaking codes. And in 1969, somebody came up with the idea of trying to break this, James Ellis. He said, we need to find a mathematical padlock. It took 3 years before a young chap called Clifford Cox joined GCHQ. Pure number theorist, fresh out of Cambridge, 23 years old, was able to make the mathematics work.
And didn't know any better.
And thought it was kind of fun and went on to the next subject.
Nobody told him it couldn't be done. And so in half an hour, he went home one evening, he'd only been there 3 weeks, somebody told him about this problem, same evening he went home, in half an hour he solves it. And I was talking to him very recently, and I said, you know, do you still have the bit of paper where you wrote it down on? And he said, oh, I didn't write it down. And I said, what do you mean you didn't write it down? And he said, well, once you leave GCHQ for the evening, you can't write down anything on paper that relates to your work.
So he did it in his head?
Yeah, so it's sort of the maths of multiplying and factoring, exponentials and modular arithmetic, what they call discrete logarithms, Chinese remainder theorem, Euler's algorithm. All these mathematical entities have to combine in a very particular way to make this work, and he combined them in his head.
He was fluent in the language.
Yes, yeah, in a way it's just like constructing a sentence, you know, for everyone else. You know, we're fluent in English, in the English language, and we can kind of construct little poems on our head maybe, and he could construct mathematical notions in his head.
Well, that's enough a fascinating analogy to go back to that notion of language, because if you think about the words you're saying as you say them, you can't get them out, you can't form a sentence, and I would think that what you're describing, and just have to believe that same process, that there is, there's some devil in the machine back there stoking the fires that makes it possible. And that by the time the words come out or the ideas come out, that something else, some other part of the brain, probably the middle brain, has helped bring these ideas together.
But Andrew Wiles, who solved Fermat's Last Theorem, I interviewed him at length, and he talks about the process of solving mathematical problems. This was a vast problem that took him 7 years to solve. And he solved it in stages. So every 6 months or every year, he'd have a moment of enlightenment which would allow him to progress to the next stage. And he would say for 6 months he'd work solidly, intensely, study it, read everything he could about it, explore every angle of this mathematical problem. And then one day he'd be walking down by the river or sitting on a bench, relaxing, and at that moment your intuition just takes over and solves the problem. You've given the mind all the ammunition it needs. It then says, okay, let me just do what I need to do. And it just comes to him in a flash of inspiration.
And the pieces fell into place?
Yes, yeah. And I filmed him, and he spoke about this, and people that have seen this documentary have said, oh yeah, no, that's happened to me. You know, I've worked solidly on an idea and failed to solve it. And then I suddenly solve it. And
when you're not looking.
When you're not looking. But you couldn't solve it without having done the hard work. You don't, these ideas just don't just appear. They appear only after you've done the hard work, but not when you're doing the hard work.
I would
There's
think.
Something really important about that, isn't there?
Yeah, I think it's, it demonstrates the point that science is not about logically progressing. It's not all about logic. There is a highly creative aspect to it, and I think people who aren't involved in science don't see that. They just see it as have a problem, do the math, solve it. You know, someone like Einstein, who comes up with a special theory of relativity, didn't just sit down, do the math, and solve it. It was an intuitive leap of immense proportions. And
my understanding is he couldn't do the math, that he had to have help with the math itself.
Yes, yeah.
Essentially at that point, all you can make sense of, at least by the terms we have available, is a striking insight based on a set of understandings, relatively unique understandings and perceptions, and the ability to synthesize in those in a new and different way, and to understand what you've synthesized, and to have that applied to the real world.
Yeah. Now, physics is slightly
different.
Nothing to
it.
Piece of cake, didn't this morning.
Sorry.
Physics, you don't need to know the maths all the time. I think it was Ernest Rutherford, one of the great fathers of 20th century physics, used to say to people, they'd come into his office and they'd say, I've got this great idea, and they'd draw this stuff on the board, fill the board with symbols, and he would just look at them and say, give me notions, not notations. You know, just tell me the ideas, don't hide it in maths. And physics is much more about the ideas that you can manipulate as images more than manipulating them mathematically. Once you think you've got something that works, you need to go in and fill in the math. You can't ignore that. But you can work a lot without math.
It's interesting. We talked recently with Per Bott, who's a physicist, among other things, a solid-state physicist, and has done a good deal of work in complexity, what is sometimes characterized as science complexity. And he talks about the change in science that I think parallels some of what you're talking about, which is it's taking it almost back to a narrative as opposed to an analytic process. That particularly as you start looking at highly nonlinear, that is to say, very complex systems that are interacting with their environment, particularly that the standard analytical models that are that allow you to identify an item, put assign a value to it or a variable to it, and then to come up with an equation that perfectly describes that every time simply does not cover the entire world as we know it. And it seems that that's the same sort of phenomenon that you're describing.
Yeah, I think there's just enormous diversity in science in approaches the one thing I try and fight against is this image of the scientist who just sits and number crunches
all by himself.
Yeah, and what I try and do. Again, yeah, I'm very proud of my books, and I've enjoyed writing them. But the documentary that I made about Andrew Wiles, it opens with him breaking down with emotion, and it shows a man who has become so obsessed with this problem that the mere memory of having solved it brings him to tears. And so it's that human aspect of science which people just don't really appreciate unless they've done science.
And he's a striking example because he did, this was late in his life by the standards we were talking about, and he did a lot of his work by himself. However, he was drawing strongly on work that had been done for centuries before, but also on work that was more or less current, and at certain critical junctures had to reach out to other people.
Yes. Yeah. No. Maths is very much a collaborative effort, and Wiles is probably an exception in the way he worked in isolation. There are always exceptions. I mean, a lovely book about maths is called "The Man Who Loved Only Numbers" about Paul Erdős, Hungarian American mathematician, who did prolific maths into his 80s. So he sort of destroys that myth that all mathematicians have to be young. And it's not just a myth. I mean, there's a large amount of truth in it. But Erdős destroys that. He also worked with every mathematician he could get his hands on. People would ring him up and say, I've got a problem. He'd fly over and work with them on this problem. And mathematicians have often talk about having an Erdős number, which means that if you have an Erdős number of 1, that means you published a paper with Erdős. If you have an Erdős number of 2, that means you published a paper with someone who published a paper with Erdős.
How far are you from the man?
I once wrote an article with a Berkeley mathematician called Ken Ribbit, and so it was a paper for Scientific American. And I'm sure Ken, Professor Ribbit, such an eminent mathematician, he's made one of the crucial steps in the proof of Fermat's Last Theorem that Andrew Wiles then built on. That I'm sure he has a connection, just 2 or 3 stages away, sort of 60 degrees of separation.
Makes you what?
I kind of hope I have an Erdős number of 4.
So this person with an Erdős number of 4 is Simon Singh. Bill Russell and I are with him. All 3 of us will be back in just a moment. I can count that high. Please be with us when we return.